Hello, and welcome to the inaugural Squared Up podcast. I'm Sarah D. Bunting of TomatoNation.com, and joining me today, and a bottle of dry Riesling in the booth, is John Ramos, who, among other things, is the reigning champion of Bunting's postseason baseball pool. John, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for the welcome. When I'm not winning baseball pools, I'm also a film producer and writer. I have my own blog at CouchBaron.com. Although I don't normally write about baseball, but we'll see what happens next year.
The one way that Terriers could be more awesome is by including a baseball subplot. It's just a thought.
It could happen. You know, minor league baseball in Ocean Beach is pretty shady.
it's shady all over. So do you have any tips for the kids on successful betting in the postseason pool?
Tips for the kids. Perseverance. This is probably the fifth year running that I've played and the first that I was not, let's say, an also-ran. might be a nice way of putting it. This year, you know, I always tried to make picks that that I thought other people wouldn't exactly duplicate. I think I went too far in past years, but this year I got very lucky with the Rangers. So, you know. Perseverance. I don't expect to win again.
I won the first year, which occasioned some calls of shenanigans, but this year was absolutely my worst performance yet, and possibly the worst performance in the history of the Bunting postseason pool. So my tip for the kids is to look at my picks and then pick something else. Because it was a disaster.
But I will say that Sarah kept her good humor through the entire performance of the postseason. She referred to her scores, among other things, as also playing, present, sigh, veil of tears, no Oblong baseball, and most simply and awesomely, ha-ha.
Yeah. I would do a list of the scores after each game and just run down the list of names and scores. And so, you know, John at one point was leading with like 250 point whatever, 77 or something like that. And then my score was ha point ha. So, yeah, that was unfortunate. I bet a strong Yankees line, and Teixeira's injury was kind of symbolic of the entire enterprise. But unfortunately, the postseason pool, whoever wins or loses, it means that the season has come to an end. John, do you follow baseball stories in the off season? Really? Because I find it really hard to focus. Like, I'm happy to read baseball books or rewatch the Ken Burns series for the billionth time, but
you know, as we know, it's a very long season. I would, you know, probably rather pop in The Bronx Is Burning and rewatch that than actually follow stories. But you know, as we were talking about beforehand, certain stories do find you, even if you're not looking for them. There's no way around it.
Yeah, true. I mean, depending on who you follow on Twitter, there are some stories that you can't avoid. In the last week, it's been the season honors like Cy Young, Manager of the Year, Rookie of the Year, so on and so forth. Did you have any thoughts on that? I was a little surprised. I believe these things are voted on before the postseason. Like, after right. The regular season, but before the postseason. And with that in mind, Buster Posey of the world champion San Francisco Giants had a great postseason, but I was a little surprised that he got Rookie of the Year in the National League. I thought Hayward was a lock. I think Hayward's going to be a great player. I think they both are, but...
Yeah, I have to admit I didn't have so strong a reaction to that. I was more kind of... I don't know if impressed is the right word, but, you know, I was interested by the strong reactions on both sides to the King Felix Cy Young, even though that's an old story. But it,
an interesting story, because I remember I listened to Baseball Today, which is the, whatever, Baseball Tonight's podcast version. I've really been enjoying Seth Everett's contributions to the booth. But I feel like he and Eric Carabel were talking about it as early as Labor Day and kind of trying to anticipate the anti-sabermetric arguments that were going to come out of the baseball press and what should be the criteria for the Cy Young and do wins. I mean, of course you want your pitcher to be a winning pitcher, but does the win reflect how winning a pitcher your pitcher is? And I thought that their argument for King Felix being more valuable to his team was a really good one.
Yeah, and, you know, I
wouldn't have been pissed off if CeCe won it or David Price.
Right, but, right. You know. And I think, you know, from the writers that I read, even the ones who are, you know, fairly passionately arguing that CeCe did deserve to win, weren't saying that, oh, well, 13 wins is, you know, a deal breaker for me in regard to King Felix. It was just they more cited that his field is not so hittable. They didn't feel that the lack of run support that he got was enough of a factor that he deserved to win.
Right.
Which I think is interesting in a broader sense, too, because I think most writers stick to the idea, well, maybe they don't, actually, but it's representative of a lot of things that happen in baseball, is that some people are willing to accept that this is the way that things are decided, you know, this award is decided.
Right.
And some people throw up their arms and say, well, the system's broken, this is ridiculous, how can you possibly entertain that? And I think it's interesting the way the Cy Young is done now. You know, of course it's going to be a matter of opinion in some ways. You know,
right.
Some people think that it should be very a lot more mathematical. I don't know if that's the case. What do you think?
Well, I think it's like a lot of these things. I mean, it's not as bad as the Oscars, where you could sort of look at these things and be like, you can't take it all that seriously. And there are, you know, certain historical awards like, I don't know, Andre Dawson being elected to the Hall of Fame. Like, I think he's a nice man. He was a very good player. When I was a Mets fan as a kid, we were terrified of the guy. But his MVP selection was a joke. And what's interesting to me, and I think this goes into, like, everything that I follow entertainment-wise, including reality TV, I want the criteria clarified. And if some of it is subjective, fine. But what's interesting to me is the discussion in the press of what the criteria were. And, you know, even analyses of past votes. Or like who decided that, well, all right, there were some interesting selections during the Second World War, obviously. And like, okay, Snuffy Sternweiss or whoever it is wins the batting title. And I'm not sure that when you get into subjective criteria that it's that easy to pin down, because everyone's going to have a different opinion of what's important. But the manager of the year is a good example of that, because Bud Black, I believe, is the National League manager of the year, manager of the Padres. No one picked the Padres to still be in the hunt on the last day of the season, certainly. One of the major criteria, I think, for people voting on how good or bad a manager is how he handles the bullpen, because that's the most, it's one of the most obvious things that you can judge a manager on. And Craig Calcaterra at Hardball Talk pointed out that he had a great year in that regard and developed a fantastic bullpen. But who knows what the criteria were?
Right. And I think, you know, with manager as opposed to, you know, with let's say, you know, the Cy Young Award, I think, you know, you can certainly make a strong case that the manager is responsible for everything that happens on the field. So in some ways, the team's performance seems a little bit more important, I would say, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, then, as a Yankee fan, I hesitate to bring this up, but then you get into the discussion of team's payrolls and, you know, what assets they had to work with, the personnel that are on hand,
exactly. And then something like the A.J. Burnett situation, which I think was, I don't know, he seemed to be very strongly tied to Dave Island emotionally. And whatever was going on with AJ this season, which I don't feel like we have any clarity on that point. I mean, I don't think he was hurt. But, you know, who knows what was going on? The guy was just giving up gopher balls left and right. But he seemed to be very sort of particular about who he threw to. And when Dave Island left the team on a personal matter for a while, he sort of went in the toilet and then came back a little bit. And I don't know how much the manager on the, you know, sitting on the bench game to game can control
sure.
this
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, and with a pitcher, obviously you're gonna feel that more than with anyone else. Yeah. So
exactly.
It's hard to, you know, and I guess all that is to say, when you're coming around to deciding on these awards, you know, there's an infinite number of you know, possibilities you could take into account and try to weigh, and as much as the guys who the writers who vote on the awards, you know, do follow and live baseball at the end, you know, it's kind of your own personal philosophy how you decide those things. So
right, and which statistics you feel are a legitimate reflection of the talent and what you did with what you had to work with, and which statistics are sort of just gaudy and don't necessarily right. tell you how much someone did to help the team win. So
right, and it is part of the fascination of the game that people are going to debate these things endlessly.
I think that's why people love baseball is yeah. that
as long as you know, as long as you avoid the, I don't know, more colorful comments on internet blogs.
Yeah, well, I think there's actually some really good baseball writing on the internet, and people are fairly measured most of the time, but then, you know, it can always devolve.
Well, I think, yeah, and these things tend to, you know, bring out the worst in people, too.
Well, let's call it an opportunity to segue to another thing we wanted to talk about, which is the number two, Derek Jeter contract negotiations, because that is really about intangibles at this point. He did not have a good year last year, but, I mean, if you're the Yankees, what do you do? How do you try to structure this deal so that you don't, A, you don't wind up looking like the bad guy, but B, you don't get saddled with the guy who's insisting on still playing shortstop when he's 42, when that was never really his value?
Right. Well,
like, defensively, at least.
You know, again, this is going to come down to, you know, I was reading a piece by, not by Ken Tremendous, but that Ken Tremendous linked to recently, where it was, you know, a really passionate defensive Jeter and his abilities at shortstop, and, you know, just basically really actually lambasting anyone who thinks that he's, you know, he shouldn't be retained.
Right.
Now, the article makes a bunch of good points, one of which I was going to bring up anyway, so obviously I found it interesting that Hal Steinbrenner said that, well, this contract negotiation is pure business, you know, we can't bring any personal feelings into it. That's, I mean, Jeter.
Good luck.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing, I'm not even saying that people should, you know, be up in arms about Jeter one way or the other, but there's no denying that he's a big part of the Yankees brand at this point.
Well, and else is he going to go?
Right.
What, is he going to be a Blue Jay?
I think it would be so bizarre for him to play anywhere else.
It's
really.
Like when Babe Ruth went to the Boston Braves, and it's just like, right. this is up. And then, I mean, that's a whole other sad story where they're like, no, you can manage. Psych.
But I do think that's, you know, it is a little bit personal the way people associate Jeter with the Yankees, especially Yankees fans. That's part of the whole branding thing, I think. You know?
Sure.
So, I don't necessarily envy the Yankees for having to put a value on that, but to pretend that it's not there is ridiculous. And I'm not saying we're even doing that, but
yeah.
You know, for... And I can understand why in the press they would want to keep it, you know, as businesslike as possible, because the more you emotionally put into it, the more he can take from you, basically. But
right. But on the other hand, that's not true, because I think that some of the commentary I've been reading has been pointing out that Jeter's agent is in the position of trying to plead Jeter's case in the press, or not plead Jeter's case, but that Jeter wants to get what he feels he deserves as a, you know, keystone player, literally and figuratively, but without coming off as a bad guy. Because I think one of the knocks on Jeter, which fair enough, is that he's relatively bland and rehearsed and inoffensive and not colorful, and not like the whatever Johnny Damon era Red Sox.
Oh, you don't find his commercials like
oh my god. Have you visited my website lately? You should really check it out. And that gigantic mustard polo shirt.
Poor
girl,
Derek.
Please. Anyway.
He did not make me want to buy a car, let's put it that way.
No. Although apparently Minka Kelly doesn't have a problem with it, and good for her.
Yeah.
But, I think that he's not in an easy position either, because I think he does have a lot of leverage, but he has to be extremely careful in how he uses it. Otherwise, right. He risks looking like he's delusional and venal, and I don't think anyone actually thinks this. But here's the problem. I think everyone wants the same thing, which is for Jeter to be, A, rewarded for years of yeoman service to the brand, but B, not to embarrass himself or the front office by, whatever, lumbering around there and, like, past a diving Jetering in 2015. It's not good for anyone. Yeah, so I think the best thing for the Yankees to do is be like, look, we're going to give you X. You can spread it out however you want. Like, we'll give you a 5-year contract that's worth X, but we reserve the right to move you to DH, or at a time of your choosing, you can retire and go to a front office job. We'll give you all the money, but you have to give us a way to get out of still putting you out there every day when you're 41 years old and you can't go to your left. You're like Zoolander. Actually, is it his left he can't go to, or his right?
I think it's his left, yeah. Yeah. I think he can't go to his left. Well,
I mean, they're both named Derek.
Yeah.
Sorry for the confusion,
Derek. Yeah, it's fine. When I was thinking about, you know, when we were discussing topics and I was thinking about what I was going to say, I totally agree that I think both sides should be very motivated to find a deal that does not drag out forever.
Quickly, yeah.
Yeah. But
otherwise, Mike Lupica gets on to the way file over 2,000 words. Yeah.
On the way over here, I noticed on Twitter that Jeter's agent came out and said that he was baffled by the Yankees' negotiating tactics in this deal.
Well, and I think one of his quotes was like, I am shocked that they've chosen to try this case in the press. Like, what the fuck?
Right. Well, hey, I guess in case anyone is unfamiliar, which I highly doubt if you're listening to this podcast, but
seriously.
The Yankees sort of floated what they were going to offer Jeter a little bit early without actually offering it. But the terms that they put out, while I would expect a counteroffer, I didn't think were ridiculous at all. I don't know what you thought, but
no, I thought it was fine. I mean, I think they just need to find a way to front load the contract in terms of his performance. And like I said, be like, look, if this is about the money, we'll give you the money.
Right.
Even if you're just in some utility closet signing baseballs and, like, visiting sick kids in the hospital, we'll give you all the money. You have to give us the option of playing somebody else at short when it becomes clear that you are embarrassing yourself.
Right.
Because that day is not far off.
And conversely, I would think that, you know, if the Yankees are going to take that tack, it would be perfectly fair to Jeter to be like, look, if I win a Golden Globe at age 40, if I win a Golden Globe, I think we discussed
based on his
Jeter is not going to be winning a Golden Globe anytime soon.
If Jeter wins a Golden winner, Glove Marissa Tomei, enough said.
At age 40 or 41, I think there should be incentives built in.
Oh,
for that.
Sure.
Sure. Maybe even beyond what they would normally be, you know, because that's such a...
But I think you can't. I think you can't put the manager in the position of feeling like that Jeter is basically running the team and controlling the destiny of the team. And I feel like, particularly in on a franchise like the Yankees, that's not. I think Jeter would be the first one to tell you that he doesn't want that responsibility. I don't think he has any interest in becoming a manager or going into the minor league system and being that guy.
Right.
But it's like, what do you see happening in your life? Like, what do you want from this? Because I'm assuming he has enough money.
Sure. Well, you
and
know,
he's come back from bad years before. Like, as a hitter, he was not good this year.
Right.
But he's come back from that before. Like, 2008, he wasn't so great. And then 2009, he was very good. So
right. I mean, one other point I read, too, is that we don't know. It's been 10 years since Jeter... negotiated a contract, and we don't really know how, you know, hard a line he's even going to take at this point, you know, for people to get this up in arms about it, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see, like, what happens after a round of negotiations, I think, before.
You know what would have been fascinating? Sometimes reading Bill James, he'll drop in some little factoids about having been part of an arbitration case for this or that player. And I would have found it fascinating if Jeter were like, all right, just for funsies. Like, but, you know, I want X for X years. Let's just sign it and get it out of the way. But then just for funsies, let's make it a dummy arbitration case.
Right, and see what
and change my name and see what they end up giving me.
Right. Well, that's interesting, too, you know, because...
But, the fact is, steroids have never touched the guy. He is the face of a franchise that, whatever you think of it, and, you know, I switched back to being a Mets fan this past season, and I've been punished for that, believe me. You know, I'm still fond of the franchise, I still follow them, and I thought Jeter was, you know, yes, overrated in some ways, but underrated in some other ways, and I think that he was an unbelievably important part of all their winning in the 90s, and, you know, this is how it works, that when you're past your prime, that's when you get the big money. So if it's not about the money and it's just about the Yankees being perceived as taking a hard line with this guy, like, no, just give him what he wants. Try to get yourself a trapdoor.
So I agree. his legs fall off.
But, yeah.
You know, as much as I would say, I think... Jeter's agents pearl clutching is a little bit much. It does seem like a little bit of hypocrisy for Hal Steinbrenner to be saying this is totally business and then to float it in the court of public opinion before it even that to me seems a little bit much.
Yeah. Well, so, and that's, I don't know. I think they're so used to playing to the cheap seats in that, you know, in that ownership suite.
Right.
I mean, it's been a weird year for the Yankees, let's face it.
Undoubtedly, yeah.
You know, and without Big Daddy there anymore.
Right.
And, you know, if Jeter leaves, that's the end of Bob Shepard on the public address system, which...
Well,
their handling of Bob Shepard was a disgrace. I realize this is like a year and a half ago now. I don't care if the man was 99 years old. He's Bob Shepard. Come in.
Yeah, my one point along those lines, I think, is that as much as I do think that you should treat Jeter right and he should want to stay, you know... If it doesn't work out and he ends up playing somewhere else, the hair shirt that is going to be Tim McCarver's commentary after that would be a sight to behold. And part of me kind of wants to hear it.
I just cannot imagine that it would get to that point. I can't imagine it would get to that point. And, I have to say, going into next season, knowing that I won't have to listen to that on Yankee broadcasts every day, like, God forbid he winds up on the Brewers or some goddamn thing.
Oh my God.
His restless ghost will still be haunting the booth at the Michael Kay Show. And speaking of restless ghosts of radio.
I thought this was going to be the
and
transition.
And television, Joe Morgan. Bye-bye!
No longer is it Fire Joe Morgan. It is Fire Joe Morgan with a D.
Oh my God. And I will say this. John Miller, I felt, was always... was historically underappreciated for his delicate but firm handling of Joe Morgan. I would also like to say that I have nothing but respect for Joe Morgan as a player. As a commentator and human being, however... 15 unqualified thumbs down.
Sarah, did you get that number 15 from a computer? I don't.
I wouldn't know, John. I haven't read the book. We'll put this in the show notes, but Deadspin recently revived the, was it the SF
it was the,
Gate?
San Francisco.
Was it the Gate or the Examiner?
I think it was the Gate.
Yeah, I think it was the Gate that they just had this guy basically...
Tommy Craig's
tone of the article was that of going upriver to the Kurtz compound, except with a much higher level of hostility and stupidity. Like, here's what I don't understand. If you feel that numbers don't tell the whole story, that's fine. I agree with you. We just spent the last 10 minutes discussing that in Jeter's case. But I don't understand why there's not room for both. And I don't understand why Joe Morgan, why someone, like, where is Mrs. Morgan in all of this? Why isn't Mrs. Morgan like, hi, Joe, you're coming off like a complete asshole. And you, like, you have to just stop.
Well, just to, you know, just to elaborate on what Sarah alluded to earlier, you know, we of course know that Joe Morgan, you know, is very anti the book Moneyball, and it's the philosophy that it espouses that, you know, you can analyze statistics, you can mine statistics for a lot more than maybe baseball purists would say you can, would opine.
Right, that there are different statistics than the ones that traditionally appear on the back of baseball cards, although I think that's actually changing.
So, right, and again, I tip my hat to Tommy Craig because this interview is just so like uncomfortable with like two exclamation points.
I think he was like physically afraid at some points.
But you know, Morgan has been lambasted on, you know, the wonderful and now defunct before its time, but now well defunct Fire Joe Morgan site. But you know, not only is he so mulish, but he has this anti-intellectual streak, I think, and it's illustrated no better than in this quote when he tells Craggs, why would I want to read, referring to Moneyball, he says, why would I want to read a book about a computer? And Craggs tells him, well, that's not actually what the book is about. He's like, well, I wouldn't know, I haven't read it.
It's okay. He's like the Sarah Palin of baseball commentary. Yeah, completely impossible.
How you wouldn't want to punch him in the face. I mean, you know, it's an interesting read, and I would totally recommend reading it if you haven't before, because he goes on to make the point that, you know, the way Morgan played the game, you know, was very much kind of a Moneyball type of game. The stuff that Moneyball
the values,
stresses as valuable is stuff that Joe Morgan was very good at. And yet he takes this, you know, completely just visceral hatred to something that he doesn't even, you know, take the time to even, you know, understand on a surface level. It's just...
The shame of it, too, is that he did have, you know, more than occasionally insightful things to say about the game and insights into various players who are now managers, guys that he played with. And, like, what a guy is thinking when he's given the hit and run sign, for example. That, for me, it's like, how do you even do that? Like, okay, it's a hit and run. You have to put it here. Like, that's just so beyond my kind of spatial relations ken. That for Joe Morgan to talk about what you're trying to do physically in that situation is interesting. It's not like he had nothing to add in the booth. But I felt like he was increasingly consumed by this sense of, like, embattled defensiveness about, you know, I don't even know what you call it. It's not really a philosophy. But it's like, why wouldn't you, if you love this game, and you're still a part of this game after all this time, why wouldn't you want to know what numbers might be able to tell you? I mean, of course there are intangibles. No one's saying that sabermetrics, like, remove all the mystery or subjectivity from the game. But he was just so angry. It was like it was something against him personally, which it absolutely wasn't.
Yeah, and, I don't think he grasped the irony at all.
For the sports leader to be, I don't know, kind of continuing to hang with that. I mean, I think they really had no choice. And it's actually a pity that John Miller is leaving, although I think he does the San Francisco games. He's they're Michael K, except, you know, less Michael K-E.
I mean, even the announcement was kind of, oh, by the way, where
well, and they were very careful to be like, Joe Morgan has chosen to pursue other opportunities, like, or shit. Although, and I'll close on this note, and it's always made me very sad. I forget why he was on the subject of that. I think it was after Dawson was elected to the Hall of Fame. In fact, I think it was because I remember listening to this broadcast. I was on a road trip earlier this spring, and it was like the first ESPN Monday Night Baseball. And Dawson had just been selected. And Joe Morgan was talking about how when he was elected to Cooperstown, they called him at home and told him that he'd been elected. And but there was nobody home with him at the time. So he got this call, and then he sort of hangs up, and he's like, I'm in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Hello?
Tumbleweed.
And then you just hear, like, the ticking of a grandfather clock, and I was like, okay, but Joe Morgan, I think this was within your power to avoid. Like, I mean, whose wife goes to the mall that day? Like, you know when you're getting to,
right.
You know when you're getting to the call, but that was, like, my one moment of feeling pity for him instead of just frustrated rage. And now the Joe Morgan era is over, and I'm interested to see who they put in the booth. I think Hershiser is getting the nod.
Is that right? I didn't see it.
His voice is a little annoying to me, but he's a good pitcher. I have his rookie card, if anyone would like to buy it. The cost is $5.
Well, the good news about following Joe Morgan is that I think he'll have a little bit of a honeymoon period.
Well, oh my God, talk about post-trade bounce. Even if they put, my God, who is that Fulio that's in the booth? Ken Singleton doesn't do that many games anymore, and they have that guy, Flaherty.
Oh, Flaherty.
The Flash. He just is completely, unexceptional in every way, as he was when he was a 15th string catcher. New York Yankees.
Well.
He is not one of our baseball boyfriends.
Speaking of not 15th string, yes.
Yeah, no. I'm going to nominate, there's a common theme here in baseball boyfriend land. My nominee is Adrian Gonzalez. Some of you may remember from my Twitter stream earlier this year, the Sports Illustrated feature The Grid, which asks athletes questions to answers to silly little questions. And one of them earlier this year was, if you had a racehorse, what would you name it? And Adrian Gonzalez's answer was Hoof Arted. I immediately, I have really no interest in the Padres. I mean, obviously I know who Gonzo is, but I was like, oh my God, that guy is my baseball boyfriend.
We could get a lot of mileage out of that, yes.
Oh, fart humor. You're in there, Gonzo. Congratulations. Well, welcome to the baseball boyfriend pantheon.
I have never heard any fart humor from my baseball boyfriend. However,
he's got a big enough ass
that he would be hip to such things. Mine has surprisingly been very constant for a long time. It's a little embarrassing, but it's Andy Pettit from the Yankees. Well, once in the Astros, but mostly for the Yankees. And last,
well, that's embarrassing for him, because his baseball boyfriend was Roger Clemens, and that's absolutely just true.
But I know he's got some extra real estate these days, Andy. That's always been true, though.
He's always had a little bit of woman ass.
Yeah, but he's I think he's got about four handfuls on him.
I wasn't really feeling you until the last couple of years, but when he started to get that salt and pepper thing going on.
Definitely, yeah, a little bit more grizzled. It suits him well. Yeah, but I'm sure that when he retires from baseball, he's going to start reproducing at an alarming rate.
Doesn't he already have
he has three kids now, and that's with being on the road all the time. So.
Wow. Well. Would you like to introduce our common thread?
Well, I will. I'm just getting to that. I was going to, just throw out one more thing, is that his middle name is Eugene, which is not a silly point.
Oh my God, that's right.
And when he opens his mouth, the Bible belt falls out. But,
oh my God.
But that brings us to our common theme, which is that both Andy Pettit and Adrian Gonzalez are very churchy. And
I did not realize.
Sarah did not know that about Adrian Gonzalez.
I did not realize before the pre-show that Gonzo was Gonzo for
I was
Jesus.
Looking around for quotes, but he told me and the press that he's not in control of his future with the Padres. God is, and he's a man of faith, which, is, if that's your thing, that's one step better than, I'd like to thank our Lord Jesus Christ for my win today, because I don't really think that the Lord really cares about sporting events, or that, he
chose
either. You to
Although
win that.
Although, I do feel but... when Albert Pujols, Pujols, I do feel that when Albert Pujols says it, I feel like they do take an interest in Albert Pujols.
Fair enough. You can get one. Yeah, but so our baseball boyfriends are both church heads. Make of that what you will.
So this is a good time to mention that my guests and I welcome reader mail and questions, which you may address to Bunting, B-U-N-T-I-N-G, as in baseball, at tomatonation.com. Tomato does not have an E in it. Joe Morgan. That's bunting@tomatonation.com. If you would like to nominate a baseball boyfriend or really anything else, I welcome your contributions. And you may also nominate someone for our next segment. A little something I like to call the Kevintheon. It's kind of related to baseball boyfriendry. But it's also known as the Kevin McReynolds Memorial Face for Radio Award.
Face for podcast. Maybe we should update our
the
lingo
face
here.
For face for iTunes. Excuse me. John, would you like to, as our guest, lead off?
You know, as I told you when we were discussing this, I am not at all prepared to make the case that this is definitely, you know, the two column proof ugliest person in baseball. However,
two column proof now. Jesus. This face, I haven't read the book, John.
I'll just say the name. The name is the pitcher Cam Macolio from the Orioles. And the reason I nominated him is that when I saw his
You turned to stone?
McFuglio, yeah. I didn't quite do the Medusa reaction, but
I had to chip John out of statue form.
Whoever was in charge of the configuration of his features on his face, I think maybe was, had a rough night the night before.
Perhaps Andy Pettit and Adrian Gonzalez could have a word with the man in charge.
Suffice it to say, his face makes me sad. My soul kind of hurts a little bit when I look at it, and I'm sure he's a lovely person, and, you know, don't email me about that. You know, it's a matter of personal taste.
What is his name?
Cam Macolio.
Cam Macolio. I have heard that name.
I may not even be pronouncing
it. Now, the test, in case you're interested for future episodes, the test of a member of the Kevintheon is whether this gentleman can survive a round of death is not an option against Kevin McReynolds. So, death is not an option. Kevin or Cam?
I would say Kevin for sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, so, then please welcome to the Kevintheon. Cam. Why do I keep wanting to call him Cam Colicchio? What's his name again?
That's a better name. Cam Macolio.
Cam Macolio. Ooh, even the name is kind of...
But I do have a runner. Like I do have an honorable mention, which is Scott Acheson from the Red Sox. Only is because he looks somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 years older than he actually is. He's 34. I would honestly, no lie, I swear to Andy Pettit and Adrian Gonzalez that I would have placed him around 60. So that's, you know, that's not a feature thing. That's just, wow.
So maybe we need a wing in the Kevintheon. That's the
maybe we need a
memorial,
hard living,
the Luis Soho SPF4 award for premature aging. Although I don't think we can call it after Luis Soho because I think he was actually 60 years old. Like, I think the man is actually my father's age, and God bless him. I loved a little grandpa.
Well, anyway, Sarah, who are you going to put in the Kevin McReynolds?
Well, obviously Kevin McReynolds, but I also feel that in preparation for this segment, I just Googled 10 ugliest men in baseball, figuring that there would be a lot of lists in the blogosphere about this. And as you know, or as you may know, if you use Google, Google offers a lot of different sort of search, like, splits for you to choose from, including videos and blogs and so on, and they put the images that you can choose from right at the top there above the fold. And of the 10 images that they provided, 7 of them were one Willie McGee, 1985 National League batting champion, and E.T. Super Twin. And I have to say, I've seen more recent pictures of Willie McGee, and I think that a big part of his problem, not most of it, but a big part of his problem, is that he was a switch hitter. Haha. And so he wore one of those batting helmets that had the, like, ear lids on both sides.
The double ear flap. Oh.
And it just, and he has a pinhead as well. And that was really not, and he had some unfortunate facial hair, and that was just really not helping. But Willie McGee was really not my thing.
You're saying, unlike Derek Jeter, he looked better with the batting helmet off.
Although, did you notice that Derek Jeter? We should put that. We should put that essay in the notes. Derek Jeter with a fro, but he has the new haircut now. He has the like 20s like Harlem Renaissance haircut. Thank you, Minka Kelly. Glad someone finally said something. But if the test is death is not an option, McGee versus McReynolds, I'd have to get with McGee.
Fair enough.
Because McReynolds is just like, I don't even, I can't. I really can't. And honorable mention goes to Ron Kittle, but that was a styling issue. That was a
glasses choice.
But did you collect baseball cards as a kid?
It's so funny that you say that, because I was just going to bring up in my Googling, as you said, the ugliest men in baseball. I stumbled upon the most delightful site, which is called the Ugly Baseball Card Blog, which wasn't completely appropriate for this because it's mostly retired players, but I was focusing on present. But if you get a chance, check it out. Google the Ugly Baseball Card Blog. There are some very funny quizzes.
Sponsored by tongue-twisters.org.
It is not written from a place of extreme sympathy, but if you like that kind of thing, I think it's worth checking out. So, no affiliation, just a...
Ooh, good tip.
So,
very good tip. The reason I bring that up is that I recently mentioned on Tomato Nation that I feel like there are cards you would get over and over again.
To answer your question, I did collect baseball cards when I was much younger.
And I got, I said that I had more pictures of Dave Steeb than Mrs. Dave Steeb. but Ron Kittle was another one that I would get over and over again. His Indians card was horrendous. And then my dad, I was talking about this with my dad, and I can't remember the name of the guy. It was some ridiculous, one of those 50s names like Remy Boudreau or something like that. That you're like, no, there wasn't someone like that. No, it's a Remo Cucurullo or something like that.
I will say too, I don't know.
Born in Naples, Italy.
I don't know what baseball cards are like today, but when I collected them in the mid to late 70s, the camera angles and close ups were extremely unforgiving.
Why would they just go in at that? It was like 45 degree angle to neck. It was like goiter cam. Everyone looked like shit. Reggie Jackson kind of looked, and then they wouldn't focus them always. And the poses, they were so sad. But I still have a lot of baseball cards from that era, and I used to get John Kruk a bunch too. And oofa. And then if I got a Met, it would always be some, I don't know.
Oh, God.
Eighth string, like, got sent down in the middle of the season or traded to the Brewers back when they were still in the American League. That's how old we are. But, I got a lot of Kittles. I got a lot of UL Washingtons and Dave Steeb. I could have wallpapered an entire wall of my room with Dave Steeb, who...
You could have.
No, I really couldn't have. Because sight impairment, would result. Well, I don't think I have a nifty segue from the Kevintheon to our next segment, which is going over some recent baseball headlines. It appears, let me just refresh this page. It appears as though the Mets have finally hired a manager. It's this Terry Collins chap.
It's Terry Collins chap.
Is that indeed a girl's bicycle? Collins chap is losing it. Speaking of inside baseball, Jesus. Sorry, everyone. And now my trackpad has totally lost the plot. Ah, yes. Okay. Mets hire Terry Collins as manager. Have you been following the Mets managerial hunt?
I have not. I have to say, and it's not...
I really felt the fact that their GM's father got hit by a... What was it that happened? He got hit by a car and died.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I thought that Sandy Alderson was a good choice for GM, and then that happened, and my first thought, Adrian Gonzalez, forgive me, was, well, this is probably going to dick up the whole managerial hunt.
Well, I feel really...
That wasn't my first thought.
I feel bad, and I should be following more. You know, I have no particular antipathy toward the Mets other than... I have one really close friend, our good friend in college, college mate Jill Stemple, who just is a diehard Met fan and, you know, gets her heart broken every year. And I guess I it's hard for me to invest in following the Mets managerial quest when I just feel like they're gonna have half their roster on the DL.
I think a lot of it really depends on whether the Wilpons are serious about staying out of the GM's way. I think Minaya made some terrible choices, but I also feel like the Wilpons had their fingers all over them. Jason Bay. Well, Beltran was no one's fault, but Jason Bay, you could have seen that coming. Pedro, you could have seen that coming.
Yeah.
Oliver Perez was mishandled in from 17 different angles. And I think whoever they hire as manager, it's impossible to tell whether that person is right for the job when you can't tell if the front office is still going to be, you know, acting like a big price tag is a sign of value. So hard to say. I have done a little reading on Terry Collins. I'm not against. I think it's really interesting to look at the story as it's been evolving over the last 6 months and see that Wally Backman was considered sort of the presumptive favorite 6 months ago, and then a month ago, all of a sudden that was just impossible. So we'll see. We'll see who's healthy, and we'll see if they have any starting pitching. I mean, I don't think it's the worst idea. Another headline I saw is that Javier Vasquez, that poor man, has apparently been speaking with both the Marlins and the Nationals. I mean, I don't think he would be a terrible addition to the Mets.
I just think some guys
can't pitch either in the AL or for the Yankees for whatever reason, and I don't think he's got nothing left. In the NL East, I mean, that's easy pickings for a guy like that. If he can keep his fastball above 86 miles an hour.
Well, the Mets manager job is just going to be trial by fire. I mean, you know that, you know, so.
Yeah.
let's just say if Terry Collins takes them to the playoffs, he's a strong case for a manager of the year. But
if he can take them to above 500 and not have one of those things where, as at the All-Star break, they're playing 620 baseball, and the next thing you know,
right.
They've been glavined sideways.
Yeah. Well, since you brought up free agency, I know we didn't have this on the agenda, but I just thought maybe we could squeeze it in. What have you heard anything about Cliff Lee's prospects? Since he's been on my mind since he basically won the pool for me, even though he didn't win the series.
Yeah, and he did well for a lot of people. I should have picked him again, and it was stupid of me not to have. Although, Matt Cain said in my Steve Holt voice, I kind of got like Cliff Lee Teague as far as the headlines, because I feel like it was a different, that it was like one of three stories. Like, the Rangers are in the hunt, the Rangers are out of the hunt, the Yankees called him, you know, Mrs. Lee doesn't want to move to wherever, Scarsdale. Right. I just started tuning it out after a while. So I actually haven't heard anything all that recent. The Yankees need him, I think, but they here's do. The thing. Yeah. I feel like they should start the season with and try to work it out with Mitre and Ivan Nova, who, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Nova, don't give your kid a name that ends with N. How about Jesse Nova? How about Bob Nova?
Aldo
Nova, Terra Nova, whatever you want. I think they should try it with some kids, because they're going to be saddled with enough aging position players. Do you know what they're doing with Berkman?
I don't know, but I was thinking before, you know, I meant to make that point. But
complete
since you
pile up and
swing it around,
DH.
Yeah. But you know, the Jeter thing too is hardly, you know, going to be an unprecedented situation for them either. I mean, it's true. Yeah. He's their, you know, flagship player, I guess. But they. Their team's old, you know?
Well, and
they
what's
figure
interesting,
out what to do.
There was a lot of discussion. I haven't been reading a lot about this now that the Yankees have been, you know, since they were eliminated from the postseason, but this was definitely a discussion when they were still in things, was that Posada is really, like, insistent on continuing to catch, even though his base runner kills numbers are, I mean, I don't think they were ever fantastic. but they were, you know, decent. They're way down. He's not hitting very well. He had a lot of, like, minor just nagging injuries. I mean, he's our age. He's not young. And he just refuses. He refuses to be moved off to first base or DH, which, where would you even put him? A. B. Apparently, some of the pitchers just think he's a cock and they won't throw to him. And it's like, well, what do you even do with that? Because right. they re-signed him to a pretty big ticket contract not that long ago.
Right.
And I think that he is a nice man and he and his wife do a lot of work for charity and that's great. But I really, this is something that I feel quite strongly about, is that there needs to be some kind of like public trust type corporation for athletes. I'm thinking of someone whose name rhymes with Schmet Schmarv. Because I feel for these guys, they've been the absolute best at this sport, which is all they do, starting at the age of like 8 years old. And then they get to 38, and it's like, what are they supposed to do? Start collecting stamps? Go to law school? I mean, I guess you could do that, but it's like, they need to have some kind of like intervention team that's paid for with the luxury tax or whatever, where some psychologist, like they have on Hoarders, goes and is like, look, your OPS is down. It's been trending downward for the, you know, last 3 years. You're starting to have back problems, which means you're going to have knee problems. I've collected the following anonymous comments from the pitching staff, and I really feel that, like, I've done this chart, and we did your personality inventory, and I think that maybe you should be a beekeeper.
I've prepared this PowerPoint presentation on why you suck.
Well, and in the case of the Jesus-y ones, it's like, right. I've prepared a Bible verse study from 2 Samuel.
God is telling you to move on.
Let go and let God.
Yeah. Short of him actually coming down to earth and like carrying you off the field.
Well, and back like, in the day when they still had to have off-season jobs and they all like had to whatever spread gravel or run a liquor store, which was pretty recent. Like Willie Mays had off-season jobs like into the 60s. Now, a couple of years being a utility infielder, and if you invest wisely, you're good.
Right.
You can figure out something else to do. But I really, I mean, it's very difficult, I think. And they're not used to sort of having to live as civilians. But the Yankees are in this position with a lot of players. And based on their handling of Bernie Williams, which I just thought was so tacky. So tacky!
It was.
And like, just cut him then. He can take it. He's a big boy. Right. He has a bant.
And they're not...
He had something else to do.
They're not that comparable, but I wouldn't blame Jeter's agent for pointing to that and being like, look, if that's what you did to that guy, like...
Oh, has he pointed to that?
No, I would... No, but if I wouldn't be surprised if you were mentally thinking that,
I wouldn't either, because that was just... That was tacky.
Yeah.
And Bernie Williams, as far as the late 90s teams went, I feel like having followed those teams at that time, he was more sort of the intangible heart. Not that I didn't like Jeter.
Right. Right.
But that was just, I mean, he was losing his abilities, that's true. But talk to him like a man and be like, look, this is a big problem and we can give you a minor league contract. We know it sucks. We also know you play flamenco guitar. Why don't you control this story and just peace out? But they just like, I don't know. I don't feel like this is a big part of why I went back to being a Mets fan. Like, at least you expect the tack from the Mets organization.
Right.
The Yankees, it's kind of like, you know, the power, privilege, pinstripes nonsense that we're subjected to on the Yes Network all the time. If you're going to be the phone company, be the phone company.
Right.
Be organized.
Right.
Or be the, whatever, be that. The Keystone Cops, like the Mets, at least you know what you're getting. Fucking Keith Hernandez talking about steak sandwiches.
Oh, Keith Hernandez, God.
God bless that.
Closeted man. Well, I would like to say that our friends Stephen Thompson and Linda Holmes will be very happy that you managed to insult Brett Favre in a baseball podcast.
that's a whole other, that's like squared up episode 1B. So I was schooled in fantasy football by someone who had Brett Favre. I was very unhappy about it.
That's not good.
It's unacceptable.
It is not cool.
All right, well, we have a couple of other headlines, but I don't think there's anything else of real interest except the Astros are for sale, which is kind of weird, and I hope it's not another divorce situation. And I think, actually, there's supposed to be a decision in that that case, the McCourt divorce case.
Oh, interesting.
Relatively soon. And also, erstwhile hero Jim Larritz acquitted of DUI manslaughter. Although I believe he was convicted of some other misdemeanor, which still is functionally a felony, and he could still get a few years.
Jim Larritz has pretty much used up his credit from that three-round run he hit back in, like, 1997 or whatever that was.
What the fuck happened?
I don't know.
It was like this, I was thinking of this, I was reading this, issue of New York Magazine, I'm way behind, but, there was this interview with Margaret Cho, and they were talking about how she had this crush on, a producer of her sitcom, J.J. Paulson, who, as it turns out, killed his wife.
My God.
And when the police were finally called, they come to the house and they find the, quote, partially mummified remains, unquote, of his wife. And then his toddler daughter is, like, walking around gnawing on, like, I don't even know, a lag bolt or some goddamn thing.
What
the shit? Exactly. So, the cops are like, what the fuckity Christ is this? And they, you know, put him in, he's in jail now. But she was, like, Googling, she was doing a past crush Google, and she found this. And then, when I saw that Larritz headline, I was like, yeah. I mean, not that he was a baseball boyfriend, but this is sort of what I mean with the, like, debriefing repatriation into society program that they should have. Like, if you were a kind of, I don't even know. Not a Greg Jeffries type. That's a whole other discussion. Like a Kevin Elster type. You held down the position for a few years. You didn't have any illusions about what you were. Squirreled away some money. Became a hitting coach. I think he's a minor league manager somewhere. He's right. Still really cute. He was one of my baseball boyfriends. Call me Kevin Elster. But I think that kind of guy is an easier time than someone like Brett Favre or Derek Jeter, because their whole part of their whole brand is their durability and the fact they're good guys.
Right. And it's funny, you were mentioning the days of baseball, you know, where people had to have jobs. Because as you know, I'm a big tennis fan. That's my probably number one sport. And you know, I used to read, you know, about when tennis was amateur, and you know, this dude was writing about. He wrote an article recently about how, yeah, back in like 1960, he was supposed to play like Rod Laver in the second round of the U.S. Open.
He couldn't get off from Kinko's.
He had to get off work. You know, it was this big thing. And, like, that's, you know, he finally convinced his boss, and then he hops on the train to get out to, like, Forest Hills or whatever.
Oh, it's my, like, God.
It's insane, yeah. But, you know, nowadays, like, I think that's part of why maybe not just tennis players, but a lot of athletes get into, you know, start charity foundations. Not to denigrate their wish to give something back, but it's also so they have something to do.
I'm sure it is. And the problem with Posada is that he's admitted in many interviews, he's like, oh, my wife does that whole thing.
Right.
I have a feeling his wife is like, you know what? Get a paper route.
Yeah.
Fuck you. I got my own shit.
Seriously.
All right, well,
type, Jorge?
Votech. Oh, two words, Tino. All right, friends. Well, we rambled on much longer than we thought, but I hope that we haven't bored you. We probably did, but I hope you stuck around to the end. Stay tuned for the next episode of Squared Up, probably coming in a couple of weeks, where we'll continue discussing the Jeter negotiations with our next mystery guest. Again, we welcome
Can't wait to do the next mystery guest.
We welcome your emails, bunting@tomatonation.com. And I think that's it. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
Pool champion, John Ramos.
It was wonderful to be the inaugural guest.
Well, thank you so much for inaugurating the podcast, and we hope that you'll come back soon.
Fantastic.
All right. Don't become a Dodger fan. All right. Take care, guys.